Welcome to Missing Persons Uncovered. I'm Caroline Humer, a child protection expert, and in this podcast series, we seek to understand the complexities of a global issue. Every year, hundreds of thousands of people go missing worldwide.
I'm Karen Shalev, and I carry out research into missing persons at the University of Portsmouth in the UK. Across this series, Caroline and I are talking to professionals to share insights into how we can all be more aware and take actions to protect vulnerable people in our communities and families from going missing.
Today, Karen is talking to Brian Frederick, who is a professor in New York City, and will talk a little bit about the LGBTQ plus community.
Hi, everyone. Today, we'll be talking to Brian Frederick, who will talk to us about LGBTQ plus people who go missing. Brian, thank you very, very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Good to see you.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you, first of all, what it is that you do and how you got involved with this kind of topic?
Sure. I'm an assistant professor of criminal justice at SUNY Empire State University here in New York City. I lead the criminal justice program for our undergraduates. I've been in this position for 2 years. Prior to that, I was at the University of Portsmouth with yours truly, Karen, for a couple of years. And I believe it was a conversation that you and I had one day about sort of shared interests on this topic that got me interested in it as a research subject. But I think I've told you in the past, I actually have experience as a missing LGBTQ plus young person back when I just turned 50 in New York City and living on the streets.
And so in terms of what it is that you do and kind of your academic background, do you want to give us a little bit
I'm one of those people that I love to talk about myself, but I don't like to talk about myself. So I identify as a cultural sort of slash queer criminologist, and that is a subdiscipline. They're both subdisciplines of criminology. Cultural criminology is sort of three factors that might lead to deviance or criminal behavior, marginalization and oppression being one of them, and how those people form subcultures, and then how the media represents these subcultures. And of course, it's also interested in how the media portrays crime control, law enforcement, etc. And then queer criminology looks at the intersection of LGBTQ plus people and crime control. So quite often when we hear queer folks talked about within the context of crime, we think of them as victims. They're just like other people. They also can commit crime and deviant behavior as well, although we don't like to tend to focus on that. It's concerned with that intersection. So how do queer folks intersect with crime control, crime, deviance, victimology, et cetera? My research tends to look at the individual or individuals in question are queer, and there's an issue with crime or deviance or the way they're treated by law enforcement. I am interested in that topic, and I will research the life out of it.
So let's define, because there might be people who listen, they would have heard about LGBTQ community or the kind of abbreviation, but right. What does queer mean?
I think that's up to each person to define for themselves. I have a coworker here at SUNY Empire. When we're saying LGBTQ plus, because it can just be such a mouthful, we tend to say LGBTQIA, and people understand what that means, right? But for me, queer encompasses the L, the G, the B, the T, the I, the A, the two-spirited, et cetera. Now, a two-spirited person or a trans person might not feel the same way, but for me, it encapsulates all that. Because I come from an older time when queer meant different and unique.
When we talk about people from the community, why would that be kind of a subcategory of people that go missing? What makes people from the community more susceptible, possibly, to going missing?
I haven't really done a lot of research on why adults, queer adults, and by the way, when I say queer, I am saying LGBTQ plus, just so we're clear on that. But I mean, the reasons why LGBTQ plus young people go missing, there are a bunch of reasons. A lot of them end up homeless because people obviously discriminate against them or they treat them badly because of who they are. And this makes them more likely to be abused and have unstable lives. And sometimes things like risky sex or even using illicit substances can also lead them to being homeless. And sometimes a lot of them will have health problems. As young people, they might also run away from home because their families don't accept them or treat them well. My situation was different. I had a lot of acceptance. We had different issues going on. I think it's safe to say The majority of these kids are in families where they have maybe heterosexual parents or a parent. And in many cases, they don't accept their queer child. And this can then lead to a cycle of leaving and coming back home and going back out again. And so it's really tough for them because they might not have anyone to turn to for help or support at home, in the community, at school, et cetera. And then on top of all that, they're more at risk of being trafficked because they might have mental health issues. Again, they don't have that family support. They may have money problems. And so being rejected by society can also make them more vulnerable. And then you've got these kids who have run away from home or been thrown away. You've got kids who might be trafficked. And then you've got kids who might be seeking asylum without their parents, so unaccompanied asylum seekers. And they may be just seeking a safer and more accepting society to live in. I work with, on a volunteer basis, with an organization called Trans Acilius here in New York City that helps trans folks coming from Middle East countries like Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, seek asylum here in the US. They're looking for a safer place to live and to be themselves. But this process for them depends on the country that they're going to. Can be really hard, this asylum process. And it can be super tough for them to get their sexual identity or even their gender recognized. The reasons these young people go missing are pretty complicated, and it just shows how important it is for us to support them and to try to understand what they're actually going through.
What are the particular risk factors that they face whilst missing?
Whilst missing, when they go missing, things can get really tough for them, especially if they end up homeless. They have to deal with mental health issues, relying more on drugs or alcohol, and even facing more violence and discrimination. They're often trying to find a sense of who they are. And a lot of them will turn to safe spaces online, but that can sometimes make things worse. We know about online bullying. And typically when we hear about online bullying, we're hearing about sort of heterosexual kids or even adults that are preying on these kids online. But this also happens within the community itself, within the LGBTQ community. And so not only are they facing discrimination from sort of outside the community, but within the LGBT community itself. And this is a reality for a lot of them. When it comes to sort of transgender and gender expansive youth, they have an even harder time. And we don't really understand their experiences well enough. And so there's like a big gap in what we know. And it's not just a few isolated cases. There's a bigger problem here with a lot of these young people going missing more than once. And this is because of problems at home, like maybe unstable family situations or even being neglected. And then again, for those who are seeking asylum, especially without their families, it's often even harder. For example, they might experience some sort of trauma, or they may have come from some sort of trauma, mental health issues that can be even worse than what other refugee children might face. And then that actual asylum process itself can make things harder with things like age checks and how much support they get affecting their mental health. There's also a ton of bias in the immigration system. You can speak for the UK. I lived in the UK for 10 years, but it's the same over here in the US. There's a lot of bias in those systems, which only adds to these kids' problems. And especially for transgender young people who seek asylum, this is why I like the word missing, which we don't often use when we're talking about these kids. And I say kids, and I don't mean that to sound diminutive. It's just an American expression, and I'm quite comfortable using it. I hope other people don't mind. We don't often think of them as missing. And yet, especially when we talk about transgender kids in this asylum process, they can feel like they're actually missing in the system because no one sees or understands their specific needs. And this makes them even more vulnerable to risks. To really help these young people, we need to come up with specific plans and ways to make sure they're safe and looked after when they go missing. And that term looked after, by the way, it has a different meaning, I think, in the UK, where it means somebody who's sort of somehow in the social services system. I'm not using it in that context. I'm using it in this context, making sure that their needs are being met and their specific needs, not just sort of lumping them into just the missing child category and treating them like another missing child. Every child has unique needs. This particular population, I think often their needs are overlooked.
I think we established that there's an element of higher likelihood or prevalence of young people. I'll use young people because we right. know that children, legally, children in most countries is up to the age of 18. Young people is up to the age of 24. So it could be children and young people. We know that there's a prevalence in going missing. We know that there's really high risks to some extent of being exploited and being a victim of violence and mental health and health issues that you mentioned. Are you aware of any prevention work that's going on? And can you give us some maybe examples or ideas of what would be useful, what is being done that is useful in preventing?
Yes, LGBT community centers throughout the US. I'm mapping services right now in Europe and the UK. And I'm actually quite humbled. And I have these moments where, and because I've collected close to 150 of these organizations in every country in the EU. Some, like Andorra, may have one, but Germany has tons, and France has tons, and the UK has tons. Some of them are very, very specific, like AIDS-Hilfe, which is an organization throughout Germany. And I'm mapping every single one of these. There may be 15 throughout Germany. I can't remember the name of it now, but they have like these, what they call contact points for refugees. The LGBT community service centers will have services for refugees. They'll have services for homeless youth. Here in New York City, especially our center, which my husband and I go to almost once a week, it's this vibrant hub where they don't sort of shoo kids out or young people out. They'll let them sit in the cafe. They use the computers. They can sit on the patio. They've got a beautiful garden in the Keith Haring Garden. On top of that, they've got programming that really sort of targets these youth. Every couple of months, I cook for, it's a group called New Alternatives here in New York City. I'm a member of a volunteer group. We cook and we serve them food. We make it ourselves. We bring it in and we serve them. And there may be 25 kids, I say kids again, but they may be 21, 22, 23 years old. They may be younger than that as well. They come to this church on Sundays and they get there around 5 o'clock. We serve them dinner and then they go off to programming afterwards at around 7 p.m. There's quite a few support services out there. I'm mapping for Europe right now. And I'm finding that in some countries, there's very little. Like Hungary, for example, you'll find with these organizations that their website is actually hosted in the UK or in Germany. And they have Facebook, obviously. I think I've touched on that point about how they like to use technology. I was a runaway without a cell phone in the 80s. And I can't even imagine. I hung out in the library during the day when I had nowhere else to go. That's sort of what led me to be homeless in New York City, was that we were staying in a hotel. I had run away from home. We were staying in a hotel with my friends from California here in New York City. And I stayed out at a nightclub and I told them I'd meet them at the hotel in the morning. And when I got back, they had been kicked out and there was no way for me to get in touch with them. We didn't carry phones back then. There's a lot of support out there. It just depends on where they are. Certainly if they have a smartphone and they have access to an internet, or even if they can go to an internet cafe, they can find these sources. And I think this project that you and I are working on right now will get the word out that if you are missing for whatever reason, you can contact this organization or that organization. And then for those organizations, I think the research that we're doing with this project, Karen, will train those organizations to meet these specific needs.
Just to clarify, it's a project we're doing with Missing Children Europe, funded by the European Commission. It's really important for us to highlight just how crucial those support points are in safeguarding children.
I just touched on the LGBTQ plus community service centers. There's like anti-school bullying organizations. There are youth services that I think I found one in Germany that is part of the Protestant church, but it's non-judgmental. The support needs of these young people can be really complex, and they're often at a higher risk of homelessness, and being part of the LGBT community adds even more challenges. It's good that they might have, depending on the country they're in, access to an LGBTQ community center or service, but in many cases they're not going to because they come from rural areas. So it's crucial that we can sort of identify what services might be available to them in the areas that they're at, and then train these people or help them to provide tailored support that focuses on things like housing, mental health services, education, and sometimes even finding employment. I had a job at 15 on Broadway in New York City working in a vintage clothing store for like a week, because somebody who was sort of, there's another kid that I met in the nightclubs out here, he said, you need to work. You need to support yourself. You can't just live off of other club kids, right? Having a strong social support system is also super important. It not only prevents homelessness, but it also helps them to transition off the streets if they're already homeless. When it comes to dealing with trafficking, it's all about using approaches that involve multiple systems, and it really puts the needs of the victim first. I cannot stress the importance of technology, and this plays a big role, especially when it comes to mental health services. I see a therapist once a month, and I do that on my cell phone, which is a very different situation than it used to be in the past. Things like online therapy, there are a lot of organizations that provide online therapy. These can be a lifeline for these young people. After a young person's gone missing, the support they need is just as diverse. So from finding housing to getting back into education, finding a job, there's so many ways that we can help them rebuild their lives. And it's not just about the practical stuff. It's also about rebuilding their sense of self and identity. One thing that's really important, and I haven't really touched on this a lot, it's one of the reasons why they go missing is the conditions at home. Rebuilding that family support, especially for those who've had conflicts related to their identity, is really important. But for those where going back home isn't an option, we need to have an honest conversation about how practical is foster care for these young people. Are they prepared to deal with the specific needs of this population? Youth shelters can also make a huge difference. If there's some sort of prevailing sentiment towards LGBTQ young people in these places, it might not be as an attractive option for them. I could go on. There's healthcare issues, there's legal support, making sure that their rights are protected. And finally, I really want to sort of touch on this point. The second you mentioned the word missing persons, right? You hear a news report, you read something in the news. It's maybe the next sentence, the next paragraph, it's going to be talking about law enforcement involvement, right? You're the expert in missing persons, Karen, but here in the US, there's this prevailing belief that a person has to be missing for 24 hours before they can be reported. And who do you report it to? You report it to the police. And then the police go out and they maybe look for these people, but these people don't want to be found by the police. They have these experiences of police that have really left a very bad taste in their mouth. So building trust with them is key. If law enforcement is going to be involved, we need to find ways to train, to work with law enforcement so that they are truly supportive and not just showing support on their face. I love that New York Police Department puts big pride rainbows on the sides of their cars during Pride Month. I love that they do that, but let's put your money where your mouth is. If you have issues with LGBTQ young people going missing, you need to sort of respect their pride as well.
It is about building that community work that all members of the community feel that they can trust the authorities. And we know that's not the case. And it's terrifying to make that call or to be out and about and all of a sudden there's a police unit stopping in front of you and you feel like you've done something really bad and you're going to be in trouble. My next question is, because you're doing this analysis for us, which is amazing, it's kind of given you a gateway into research around the world. You touched a little bit on the EU, but do you have a feel of patterns of things that are happening for people in the community around the world?
It's really important to note that most of the research on this topic comes from the US. To a lesser extent, the UK and other Western countries like New Zealand and Australia might have a couple of studies. But we just don't have enough data from regions like the Global South, Asia, the Middle East. And this is important when you're talking about people who are seeking asylum or even being trafficked. I used to teach trafficking. I think it was the state crime class at Portsmouth. There's certain countries that young people are trafficked from and to. But we don't have a lot of information on what sort of percentage of these people are LGBTQ. In terms of patterns, what I have seen is that these youth are disproportionately represented among those who go missing, especially due to homelessness. In the US, and this is such a hard number to pin your finger on, but they make up only about, LGBTQ plus young people make up only about 5 to 8% of the total youth population in the US. I don't know who came up with that number. I'm not a statistician. I wouldn't want to try to do that type of study either because I wouldn't be confident with that number, but 5 to 8%. When it comes to homelessness, they make up about 40% of that. Wow. And one of the main reasons for this overrepresentation, I think, is family rejection after coming out. Let's face it, you don't actually have to come out as a queer kid, for your parents might have a sense before you've even come out, which can make it even more difficult for these people to come out. But this can lead to unstable living situations. So that's a pattern, like running away or being expelled from their homes, these throwaways, that's a pattern. They're also significantly overrepresented rather in foster care systems. Pattern stigma, discrimination, heightened risk of trafficking with LGBTQ plus youth. They're five times more likely to be trafficked than their heterosexual peers. And this is often due to rejection and alienation they might experience, mental health patterns, depression, suicidal thoughts, even suicide attempts. Here in the US, we have a number people can call. It's a crisis line, 988. So it's like your 911, but 988. And we realized that this sort of subpopulation of youth who are in crisis was so important that if you press number three when you dial 988, it will take you to a person who is trained to handle LGBTQ plus youth issues. That's how big that is. It's significant. I don't know that the UK has a similar mechanism, but I'm always telling people, look, if you need help, dial 988 and then just press three and you'll get somebody who speaks your language.
That's really important. That's one of the reasons why we wanted to do this podcast, is to share good ideas with people. If you see something that works, that it's just simple to implement. There's so many hotlines out there that support people. Why not add to your service exactly that, a specific line for LGBTQ people?
I was so bewildered when I got to New York City and realized that there was an LGBTQ plus center. So it's good that this 988 number, people are talking about it more here. I was just interviewed by my university about this topic because I had told them I had just completed this presentation for the consortium in Brussels. And they asked me, they said, is there anything else you'd like to add to the conversation? I said, yeah, there's this number that you can call. If you or someone you know is in trouble, there's this number that you can call. And number three is the option for people who speak your language.
Now that we understand it all, how do you link queer criminology with LGBTQ plus people going missing?
I'm probably going to be the first queer criminologist to actually apply that sort of framework to this phenomenon. Queer criminologists are, they're used to, when we started, what, 12 years ago, there were maybe 10 of us throughout the world, maybe probably less. I remember we all met at a conference in Atlanta, Georgia, and now there are over 400. So with students in class, I go ahead and do a search for queer criminology. I'll tell them, do a search for queer criminology in the library, on the library's database, for like 2012 and see how many articles come up. And there's just a handful. Okay, so now do a search without that year. There's like thousands of articles now. It's really grown. You might have queer criminologists that are looking at homelessness. You might have ones that are looking at trafficking, but you don't have anyone looking at this as a missing phenomenon.
What we're missing is seeing it as an overall issue. People go missing and they go missing for different reasons, but they're still missing.
Even though queer criminology hasn't really explored this topic yet, it could give us a way to see why these young people might go missing more often, for example, like maybe family rejection or discrimination, which we're very familiar with in queer criminology, plays a part. It can also show us, I think I touched on this at the beginning, about queer criminology is also interested in sort of law enforcement and crime control and LGBTQ folks' interaction with them. Queer criminology could show us why cops might handle these cases different or not handle them at all, which is super important to try to determine.
I would say there's a few cases that I know of people from the community, men actually in those cases, who were murdered, and it turned out to be serial murder cases that were not linked together in different countries because they were from the community and it wasn't investigated properly.
I don't know if your listeners might be familiar with Stephen Port. They call him the Grindr Killer in East Barking, London. But the cops weren't putting it together that these four men who had been found murdered and left in the same churchyard with a suicide note were linked. It's called linkage blindness, where they don't see the links because they don't understand it. Happens all the time.
Is there anything else or any takeaways you'd like to share?
I'm super excited to be doing this research right now, especially because I have experience as a member of this population, not just because I identify as queer, but because I went missing. But what's even more humbling is to realize that I went missing for different reasons. So I can't actually lay my template down over this research. Every day I'm learning something different about a different reason why somebody might go missing or stay missing.
I think that's a really, really important point because we have a tendency of stereotyping and grouping things.
Yep.
You're the perfect example of why investigators and all of us should keep an open mind, because you never know. You didn't fit the profile, and yet you did go missing. And I think it's really important for people to remember that until you find the person and you ask them, what happened? Why did you go missing? We don't know. We can make assumptions. I hope that we just open the window to the people to explore that a little bit more in their own minds and to be open to why people go missing.
Not only are they're missing from the data, which is why I love the word. They're missing in sort of every aspect of this. They're missing. And we're going to find them.
Excellent. Thank you very, very much. It's been really interesting and helpful.
Thank you for joining us today. And thank you, Brian Frederick, for sharing your experience as well as your insight into the research. I look forward to reading it.
If you have any questions you would like us to answer or thoughts on topics you would like us to discuss, please contact us through our website. If you'd like specific information or need help, please reach out to your local police department or national charity. If you are enjoying this podcast and discussion, please help support us by buying us a coffee through missingpersonsuncovered.com.
I'm Karen Shalev.
And I'm Caroline Humer. Thank you for listening. This is our last episode for season 3. Please join us for season 4 in 2025.